Do pobiedonostsev. The words echo in my ears to this day. You know how it is, that certain incidents stick with you, often for no particular reason. It's the insignificant things that you have a clear memory of. It was the beginning of my final term at university. The final exams were about 6 weeks away. We were sitting in a supervision, a small tutorial, deciding what we should study for our final topic. It was for the Russian history paper, Russian history, 19th and 20th centuries. In the exam, we'd have to do 4 essays in 3 hours. So we really needed to have covered 5 topics well, because you never knew quite what questions would come up, and best to have 6 topics, and even another backup would be good. Well, we'd covered most of that in the course of the year. We'd need to decide which of the topics to revise. But for now, the question was, what topic should we take for our last essay? Do pobiedonostsev, boomed the supervisor. I never knew why he spoke so loud, since there were only 3 of us in the room. I can't remember now who pobiedonostsev was. I didn't get a time before to look in my Encyclopedia Britannica. I think he was one of the last prime ministers under the Russian Tsar at the end of the 19th century. But I do know that I wasn't very interested in pobiedonostsev. I preferred to do something from the 20th century. My fellow student was from Glasgow, a hardline Trotskyite and a member of the Socialist Workers' Party. She too was rather uninspired by the idea of an essay on a Tsarist prime minister. Do pobiedonostsev. Well, might it be possible to look at something more recent? Could we have a second bite at something we've already looked at? I'm not sure I'd be likely to answer a question on pobiedonostsev in the exam. Do pobiedonostsev. In a firm and not unfriendly voice, one sensed that he realized that we were reluctant and understood it, but he wasn't going to move, budge his ground. Do pobiedonostsev. Then the penny dropped. Always quick to pick up subtleties, my razor-sharp mind suddenly clicked. There was a reason for his insistence. He wasn't just being stubborn and eccentric, although he was probably being those too. He was, after all, the man who set the exam paper. Probably in the previous week he had just been setting the questions for the exam paper. Do pobiedonostsev might be a rather useful hint about what might just come up in the exam. And so it turned out. As I said, I can't remember the first thing about the man now, except for his name, for some reason sticks in my mind. But I know that I revised that topic very thoroughly. I reckoned it was a dead cert that it would be in the exam, after all the hints he'd given us. So you could say that having that piece of information about the future affected the way I lived, in a small way, over the following few weeks. A principle that's true in all sorts of areas of life. Knowing what lies ahead affects how we live today, our priorities, our attitudes, what we spend time doing, what interests us, and so on. And often we don't know what lies ahead. In fact, usually we don't, so we can't prepare that much. But there is one important thing that we Christians do know about the future. That is that death is not the end. In a sense, it's more of a beginning, a new beginning perhaps. So it's not something to be feared. And that's not just something which is to be a comfort to us one day when we're old and decrepit and near death. It's easier for us when we're younger to put off thinking about death and so on. It's rather gruesome and macabre, and we can do that later. But actually, having the right attitude to death, having the right attitude to the future in that sense, should affect our day-to-day life, our attitudes, our priorities, our concerns. And we'll see that tonight in the example of Paul. What he was certain of about the future affected the way he was living day to day. We don't know all the details about his situation. We know he was in prison. We know the outcome was uncertain. He was hoping to have another chance to visit his brothers and sisters in Philippi, but he knew as well it could be that he would be put to death and never released. But as far as he is concerned, the most important thing about the outcome is clear. Verse 21, "For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." And that conviction about the future affected the way he lived. We're going to look at three lessons we can learn from Paul, three ways in which he can be an example to us. First is confidence. That's the first thing I find striking about his attitude here. It's that the passage breathes confidence, especially about the future. You sense an underlying peace as we read these lines. You may remember we've already seen it a little bit. For example, I think it was 2 weeks ago, we saw how much confidence he had in the power of the gospel in spite of all the failings of the people who were preaching the gospel. Whatever his circumstances, again and again in chapter 1, we found him standing confident, even relaxed, in the present because of what he knows about the future. Well, two further questions. What is he confident about? He's confident about his destination. As I said, he knows where he's heading, whether he lives much longer or dies soon. He will one day be with Christ. So death was not something to fear, but actually to look forward to. The other thing he's confident about is Christ's exaltation, that Christ will be exalted. I think that's Erhoben, verse 20, we saw last time. "I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now as always Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death." Either way, he's confident Christ will be exalted in him. He's confident not just that death is not something to be feared, he's also confident of things working out in broader terms. In English, you could describe that as a win-win situation. Whatever the outcome, he knows he's going to win. That's what he sums up briefly in 21. To live is Christ, win. To die is gain, win. What will death mean? Gain, because he'll be with Christ. What will life mean? Well, it won't be a waste. It'll be gain, because it will be fruitful labour. If I'm to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labour for me. He's very confident. And what is the reason for his confidence? On what is his confidence based? If you think about it, he could just be whistling in the dark. He could be just trying to keep his spirits up in a hopeless situation and ignoring the realities. It could be a sort of naive determination to see every silver lining and ignore the dark clouds. Certainly, that would tie in to some extent with the surrounding society. They, it seems, viewed death as a good thing, as an escape away from problems in this life. But it was an escape into nothing. Paul knew his destination. He knew it would be release for something good. Well, we've already seen in previous weeks hints of his confidence, verse 12. "I want you to know, brothers, what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel." Tough times, good times, it's all served to advance the gospel. And verse 19, I know that through your prayers and the help given by the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. But I think the clearest statement of what lies at the base of his confidence is in verse 6. Again, the passage we looked at. Being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. Quite simply, he is confident in God. He believes God is sovereign, by which in English we mean, it's probably not quite the same as souverän in German. We really simply mean he's in control. He's the king. He can give an order and it happens. He's sovereign not just over death, but over all areas of life. And that affects Paul's attitude not just to death, but to all of life. It's a secret of this relaxed confidence he has. The reason he can cope so well with all the pressure that he's under. The reason he can be relaxed rather than stressed. He knows that God is sovereign. His whole life, certainly in this chapter, speaks of a relaxed confidence in a sovereign God. So ask yourself, what does your life speak of? A relaxed confidence in a sovereign God? My application, my lesson here is that we need to cultivate, to work at developing in ourselves a relaxed confidence. Not thinking that it all depends on me and going into headless chicken mode and rushing round thinking unless I get all these things done, God's kingdom will collapse. Nor is it the opposite true, that nothing depends on me. I can just switch off and God will get on with it anyway. God calls us to be fellow workers. But he calls us to get on with the job, to be fruitful in our labour with a relaxed confidence in him, putting things in his hands and leaving things there. Don't know about you, but I'm quite good at the first and rather less good at the second. Putting things in God's hands and leaving them there. Trusting him, a relaxed confidence that he will work things out. Well, a relaxed confidence doesn't mean that there'll be no problems, that everything will be easy. On the contrary, the second thing we learn from Paul's example is conflict. Paul faced, as you will know, many different conflicts in his ministry as he followed Christ and served him. But the conflict we get a glimpse of here is the conflict within. Second half of 22. Yet what shall I choose? I do not know. I am torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far. But it is more necessary for you that I remain in the body. He simply doesn't know which to choose, death or life. In a way, it's a theoretical discussion. It's not actually up to him to choose. Suicide is not an option. God will choose for him. You might say, well, he could save himself a lot of trouble and angst by stopping thinking about the choice. But things aren't ever that simple in practice. The heart experience isn't always as logical as our minds might or might not be. And what he's doing here is expressing what is going on inside, in his heart. So we don't hear a well-argued scientific thesis on a Christian attitude to death. What we have here is the inward wrestling of a man for whom the problem of life and death was real, was actuel. It may not be up to him to decide whether it will be life or death. But the inner tension is there as he faces the possibility of either outcome. He's pulled in two. What shall I choose? I do not know. I am torn between the two. And he describes the choice as being between what is better And what is necessary, the better thing, is there in verse 23. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far. His whole mind and being are filled with Christ. He can't think of anything better than being with Christ. It may seem somewhat extraordinary to us that he's so keen to leave this world. Odd, perhaps, that he expresses his desire in such terms to be with Christ. It seems odd, but many of us find ourselves at some time in a similar sort of situation, or we observe a similar situation. Think about two people who are in love, as it's sometimes described. Suddenly their minds are empty except for one thought, their beloved. Suddenly their hours are filled with one person, their beloved. They have no other desire than to be in one another's presence. It may seem rather odd to the outside observer, but to the participant, it's the most natural thing in the world to want to spend time with their beloved. And I think what we see in Paul is not really so very different. He loves Christ. He is in love with Christ. And for that reason, he can think of nothing better than to be with him. That would be the better thing. But there is another thing which is necessary. Verse 24, it is more necessary for you that I remain in the body. It's not for his own sake or his own benefit that he's willing to remain, but entirely for their sakes, that it may be necessary to remain. And so he faces this choice, this inner tension, between what, if you like, he desires for himself and what is best for those he loves. And I suspect we tend to have the better and the necessary the other way round. We think it's better to stay here. That's what we'd prefer. But we're willing to move on to the next life, a bit reluctantly perhaps, if it's really necessary, but hopefully not too soon. Paul's attitude is pretty radical. I don't think that means a sort of cavalier and insensitive attitude to death. You know, if you hear that someone's dying, you go to them and congratulate them and say, I wish I could come with you. Doesn't mean going to an old people's home and congratulating them all that they'll soon be with Christ. Obviously, we have to be sensitive to those who are going through the process of acceptance, coming to terms with it. Obviously, it does leave great grieving in those who mourn, who are left behind. We have to beware of both extremes, downplaying death and behaving as if it's rather unspiritual to mourn. And on the other hand, overplaying death and behaving as if it's an unmitigated disaster. It isn't unspiritual to mourn. Of course we suffer loss, whether we're the one who's facing death or the one whose loved one is dying. It's right and good to mourn. But on the other hand, it's not the worst thing that can happen. It's actually the best thing that can happen to a believer. And I think it's important that we work now to get our thinking clear. I've put this on the overhead as we need to cultivate a Christian worldview. We need to cultivate, get into the habit of thinking as we ought as Christians, as Paul does, about death and life, about what is better and what is necessary. Remember Pobiedonosce. Knowing what is coming in the future expects how we live now, how we use our time now, our attitudes now. If we've not thought through what it means to have that destination, then our life won't fully reflect that reality. Mike and I both did, during our training, theological training, placements with a clergyman in the northeast, in Newcastle, in England, whose son has cystic fibrosis, which means that if he lives into his teens, that's a miracle. If he gets beyond 20, that's a miracle. Although medical science has been increasing as the boy's grown older. He must be late teens now, I should think. But I remember Ken saying to me at the time, James was 6 or 7, and they didn't know, would he die in a few days? An infection could come, or might he last many years? And Ken said, I'm so glad I got my thinking sorted out before James was born. He got his thinking sorted out so that when the disaster happened, if you like, he was ready for it. He'd thought himself through. He was prepared. He could cope better than suddenly being hit by it. Similarly, we need to be using good times when things are going smoothly to prepare ourselves to cultivate a Christian worldview which will carry us through the more difficult times. And the third thing to learn from Paul is something which comes out of that last point. It's actually something we've seen a bit before. I won't spend so long on it. Is his concern, and a couple of things he's concerned about. Mike pointed out last time, 2 weeks ago, Christ meant more to Paul than his own comfort. And from this passage we have to add, Paul's Christian brothers and sisters at Philippi were also more important to him than his own comfort. Their needs came before his desires. It was his love and concern for them which made him willing to stick around as long as God wanted. It is more necessary for you that I remain in the body. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain, and I will continue with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith, so that through my being with you again, your joy in Christ will overflow on account of me. What is it he's concerned about for them? He's concerned about their progress and joy in the faith. He's concerned that they should be growing, that the gospel should be taking root in their lives and prospering. Simply, I'd want to say, those two things need to be held together. His concern for them, and his concern for the work of the gospel in them, are both inseparable from one another. If he truly loves them, he'll be concerned for their progress in the faith, and he'll be willing to put himself out for that. Any minister who loves his flock will be concerned for their progress and joy in the faith. Any Christian will be concerned for his fellow or her fellow brother or sister to be making progress in the faith. It seems to me that having those things in place, having that concern for others and for the work of the gospel in their lives, sets Paul free to serve them. What you don't find by Paul, I can't think of any examples, is complaining, moaning about the hardships and the difficulties. Of course, he does express the fact that it would be lovely to be through with it and be with Christ in eternity. But he doesn't complain. He rejoices to be able to serve other people. I want to say that I think that's a result of a gospel mindset, a mindset which sees God's work in people as the most important, which is my final point, my final lesson. Cultivate a gospel mindset. Du pobiedonosnym, said my eccentric lecturer. Let what we know about the future influence what we do today, this week. Let what we know and think and feel about the future affect how we behave, our attitudes, our Einstellungen. Cultivate a relaxed confidence. Get into the habit of trusting God and leaving things in his hands, and getting on with our side of things in a more relaxed and less stressful way. Cultivate a Christian worldview. Get into the habit of thinking Christianly. For most of us, that means big changes in the way we think, to bring our thinking in line with God's thinking. It'll be hard work, so we need to cultivate it and work at it. And cultivate a gospel mindset, concerned for others, committed to see others growing in the faith, willing to put ourselves out so that others can make progress in the faith. And it all starts now. So let's pray now.